Pleasure to introduce my colleague Dave Rissmiller, who was the 28th president of the Forum Club and a longtime member of the program committee, along with several others here. He has brought I don't know how many speakers to the club over the years. He's close to my record, and he's brought a very special one today. So I'll turn it over for his traditionally short introduction.
Maybe a few of you were here a few years ago when I was introducing a speaker. I got up here to introduce, and I found the last student that spoke took my agenda and also my introduction for the speaker. So that was the shortest in history for me. Okay. Before introducing our speaker, I have a special person, special guest I'd like to introduce to all of you. And Marge. Maybe I don't want to introduce a speaker. Maybe something's happened. Seriously, special guest that's here today, and I'd like her to stand and be recognized because our speaker, active military, through almost 39 years, and he and his wife moved 17 times. 17 times, ladies and gentlemen, over that 39 years to rise to four-star rank. Marge, would you please stand? Okay, moving on to the main event. It keeps falling down, I'm sorry. Our speaker has quite a history, quite a record in serving our country. Done many things. He earned his commission in an ROTC program, and I believe it was 1975 when he got his received the commission. And within 9 years, he had risen to the rank of, I think, lieutenant colonel, which is reasonably rapid, those of you that are aware of the military. And by, I got to look at my notes to get the right year. By July of 1989, he had one star on his epaulets, only one in 1989. And moving right along, by the time by the time October 12 came around of 2007, he had four stars. Okay? That comes after three. So quite a rise to star rank. And if you look at his record, you look at all the accommodations he's received, you will see he has an outstanding record. In fact, if I tried to read them to you today, they fill one full page, small print, and some on the next page, small print. And I will just mention a couple of the significant accommodations, and that would include, these are major, Defense Distinguished Service Medal, Distinguished Service Medal with Oak Leaf Clusters, Defense Superior Service Medal, Legion of Merit with two Oak Leaf Clusters, Defense Materia Service Medal, Materia Service Medal with three Oak Clusters, and then an Air Force Commendation Medal. The rest of them fill this page. All the things that he has received awards. So in order to keep this very short, Ellie, where are you? There she is. In order to keep this very short, I would like to move right along and end up by saying, I think all of us should join in welcoming with a Forum Club applause our general who has been so much to the peace of this country. General?
Thank you, David. Okay, there are two microphones here, one on me and one there, and one of them has got to give, or we're going to get this horrible noise. Okay, can you hear me? Is that better? All right. Well, thank you, Dave, for that introduction, and I must say, Dave, Ann, it's nice to reconnect with people from Omaha, but it's nice to do it in Florida. Because if we were in Omaha, that would be snow outside, everybody, and that's not what we are really interested in. So you've had a whole long, something is happening here. You've had a whole long list of very distinguished speakers here, and I am flattered and honored to be invited to come and talk to this group. Now, I must say, before we got started for lunch, I went to the restroom to adjust my necktie and make sure that all the pieces were in place and this and that. And I'm not sure what happens in the ladies' room, but in the men's room, you don't make a lot of eye contact. And so it's a rule. It's a men's room rule. You learn it when you're very young. And I was standing there adjusting my necktie, and somebody standing over here said, "Geez, I hope that guest speaker's good." And I said, "Yeah, me too." We'll see. You can be the judge of that in a little bit. This is the first time that Marge and I have actually been in Naples. When Dave contacted me about a year ago, I said, "Honey, you want to go along? I'm going to give a speech in Naples. You want to go along?" And she said, "Of course." And she was a little surprised yesterday when we got to the airport because we didn't actually go to Italy. We came down here. But those clothes you packed for Italy, honey, they are perfect here in Naples, Florida. There was a little piece that I left out of the invitation. I thought she knew we were coming to Florida, but as it turns out, here we are. So, but being in Florida, this is all I've got, by the way. I don't have a real speech. I've just got a couple of jokes to, tell you. But I'm reminded of a couple who began dating later in life, and they got serious, and they got even more serious. And one day, the man said to the woman, "Honey, we're getting pretty serious here, and I think at some point I want to pop the big question to you, but before I do that, I need to tell you the truth about me. I love golf. I love everything about golf. When I'm not playing golf, I'm at the range. If I'm not at the range, I'm watching golf on TV. When I'm not watching golf on TV, I'm out testing new equipment, and I'm going to the golf stores, and I'm buying all the stuff. And so you just need to know that. That's what you're getting into." And she said, "You know, I'm really glad you shared that with me, because I've got something to share with you as well. For the last 5 years, I've been a hooker." And he says, "Well, that's no problem. Just keep your wrist straight and follow through." So I was afraid Dave was actually going to read my bio, and I'm glad that he didn't, because I can tell you this, that through the whole time that we've been married, Marge's favorite expression has been, "Don't pull that general crap with me." So at home, that gets me absolutely nothing. So, but it's a very nice introduction, and I do appreciate that. And I am quite serious in saying this is a real honor for me to be here and to talk to a very distinguished group like this. Monday was Veterans Day, as you heard Joe mention that. And I must say, when I'm traveling in particular and I get out my retired identification card, my military retiree card, and I hand it to people, frequently somebody says to me, "Thank you for your service." And I must say that that makes me very uncomfortable. And it makes me uncomfortable because generals get to stand in front of groups like this and take credit for things that other people do. The people who we need to be thankful for are the youngsters that serve our nation. They are remarkable. They are brave. They are highly capable. They are intellectually at the top of anybody's chart. I didn't join a bad military in 1975, but I left a better one, and it's because of those young people, and I think they deserve our applause. But there's another group I think that deserves our applause as well. Would the veterans in this audience please stand up? Can I ask you to do that? Thank you. Thank you to all of you for what you've done for all of us and the broad shoulders you provided for people like me to stand on. So in the mid-1980s, I served an Air Force legislative liaison. That was a great learning experience for me. What I discovered was, much to my surprise, that the way a bill becomes law is not the way the little civics book says a bill becomes law. It's a lot different than that. I learned an awful lot, but here's something else I learned. When I was in legislative affairs, many members of Congress were veterans. And in fact, maybe most of them were veterans. Many of the veterans were World War II veterans. And here's my observation. I think that fact allowed them to build a veterans bridge between Democrats and Republicans. They shared a common bond. And they didn't agree on policy as I watched them go about their work, but they shared a common bond. And at the end of the day, I think they were pretty clear about how they needed to work together for the better of the country. Look at Senator Bob Dole and Senator Dan Inouye, two combat veterans of World War II, a Republican and a Democrat. I get to be around them a little bit, not much. I don't profess to know either one of them or knew Senator Inouye, but I got to work with both of them over the years. And I can tell you they were both highly complimentary and respectful of one another. So I think there's something about veterans that allows us to bridge those kind of gaps, and I think it's unfortunate that we don't see as much of that today, and maybe the reason for that is there aren't as many veterans serving today. I'm not sure. So there's an old saying that I always thought was a Chinese proverb, but I went to the internet, which is the source of all knowledge. And of course, if it's on the internet, it must be true. Not enough people laughed at that, by the way. Makes me worry about all of you. But anyway, so it was. I went to the internet and I looked at the old, what I thought was a Chinese proverb, may you live in interesting times. The internet says that's not a Chinese proverb. It's an anonymous thing from somewhere. Okay, let's embrace it anyway. May you live in interesting times. And that's something that people have been saying for a very long time, and we certainly do. But at United States Strategic Command, which I was fortunate to command before I retired, which was the old Strategic Air Command from the Cold War days, and the other military commands, they're not paid to live in interesting times. They're paid to deal with interesting times. We live in a time of extraordinary change, from the way we communicate and travel, to the medical care we receive, to the way we shop, to the international threats we face. Change is occurring all around us. But change isn't new. Most everybody in this room has been around long enough to have seen tremendous technological advances and real existential threats to our national survival. So, what's all the fuss about? Why are we so fussed up about what's going on today? Well, I think we face a completely different set of national security challenges today than we did when I joined the Air Force at the height of the Cold War. So let's take a minute to talk about a couple of the challenges that present special problems for all of us, especially those who are responsible for our national security. So we live in an era of tremendous speed. The engineers in the room would tell you there's a difference between speed and velocity. Anybody know what the difference is? Direction. Velocity has a compass heading associated with it. Speed does not. I think we live at a time of tremendous speed. Everything seems to be going faster. Time does not appear to be on our side. Policy is way behind technology. Just look at autonomous vehicles. How many of you drive Teslas? Do you hit the autopilot button? Is our society and our highways and all that stuff ready for autonomous vehicles? I don't think so. But we're going to have them anyway. We already have them at some level. We've got technology way ahead of policy. Gap is getting wider by the day. Nobody relaxes and everybody demands more while they go at a frantic pace. We live in a time of unprecedented access. You can access places and people and information in hours and minutes and seconds and through cyberspace in milliseconds. You can travel anywhere you want just about on the face of this planet within the next 24 to 36 hours. If you have the right airline connections, if you're coming through Charlotte, forget it. But anywhere else, just about, you can go 24 to 36 hours. And it's really true, and you can get there to most places on the face of the planet, travel there just like you were standing there through cyberspace. And you can do it in milliseconds, and you can do it see if I can pull this out from right here. Isn't this incredible? I mean, think about what's going on here. What does it take to make that all work? And whether you like it or not, here it is. Whether you like it or not, these other technology changes are giving us unprecedented access. There was an old movie, Honey, I Shrank the Kids. I think my generation shrank the globe. And I think that's probably true. We live in a time of ultra-high volume. Volume can be a measure of amount, a bucket full of something. It can also be a noise level, high volume. That's decibels. Everything, information, data, conversation are all at extreme volume levels today. Everyone is drowning in information or shouting, usually at one another, and it's almost impossible to tell the difference between urgent and important. Look at the ticker across the TV screen. Urgent breaking news. You know, dog bites cat. And you go, what the? You know, I've shortened the big questions to what the, get the, and shut the. You know, what the, get the, shut the. Anyway. You know, when I was a kid, I remember watching with my parents the evening news, and Marge and I watch that now. It's the old people's news because they advertise all the old people drugs. There's a weather segment, and it used to be that they would say it's going to rain tomorrow. Today, 50 million people are in danger from the rain. They're telling us to be afraid of everything. And I think that's something about the times we live in, too. We live in a time of fiendish complexity, law, finances, relationships, systems, programs. Everything seems difficult to understand. The relationships between them create new issues for us and some change over here. It's the old butterfly. Wings flap over here, and over on the other side of the world, a tsunami occurs because of the connection between the two. We're connected in ways today that we never thought we would be connected, and we rely on a relative handful of subject matter experts to help us decipher the complexity. When was the last time you could go to your workplace or even home, sit down in front of the computer, and something went wrong, and you went, I've got no idea how to fix this. No idea. You call some subject matter expert who shows in and says, oh, well, you open this file, and you click over here, you move that over here, and by this time, I want to throw that guy and the computer out. I can't figure it out myself because it's too complex. We live in an era of sharp divisions. Everybody's picked sides. Everything is characterized as win versus lose. These issues shape the way we are trying to deal with serious national security problems. We live in a time of new vulnerabilities. Somebody can enter your home, your business, or a secure government area and steal the most important things and never physically be there. They can do it through cyberspace. Worse, an insider can do that while authorized to be there by you because you trust them. Edward Snowden, for example, was there because he was trusted. So, these are different times that we live in. Here's another troubling aspect of our times today. By the way, if you're waiting for the part where it gets better, yeah, forget it. Nope, you're going to be disappointed today. No, I'm going to try to help here in a second. But first, I've got to make it worse. So it's not new that our homeland is at risk from potential enemies. That was the Cold War, right? We lived with some sense of urgency that the Soviet Union could attack the United States in a major way in minutes. I spent the early part of my career sitting there on nuclear alert, deterring that. Those people are still sitting there today on nuclear alert, deterring that. But the sense of urgency maybe has declined a little bit. But still, we've faced that kind of threat before. What's new? Well, what's new is today that our homeland is at risk below the nuclear threshold. It's at risk through cyberspace. It's at risk from long-range conventional weapons, soon to be traveling potentially at hypersonic speeds, and therefore, we're at risk from a larger pool of potential enemies than just the monolith we faced in the Cold War. And speaking of potential enemies, Russia didn't go away at the end of the Cold War. They're still very ambitious, and they're aggressive, and they have already modernized their nuclear forces, for example, and other conventional forces as well. China has its own ambitions, pursuing a strategy that will have them take a prominent, maybe in their view, the prominent place in world affairs. North Korea is nuclear armed. Terrorists still exist, and the list can go on. But here's the bottom line. Threats can arrive today at our doorstep very quickly and range from small arms in the hands of terrorists to nuclear weapons in the hands of hostile nation states. Time and distance and boundaries and ambiguity and asymmetry characterize warfare today. And as I said, nuclear weapons are still with us for as far into the future as I can see. This is a time of decisive consequences. Business decisions, personal behavior, and innocent mistakes are instantly and publicly debated and judged. This can make organizations and leaders far less willing to take risk at the very time when we're going to have to take some risks in order to keep up with the threats we face and the pace of change in the world. Now, I would argue that the United States still leads the world militarily, economically, and certainly in the ideals that we represent. But our future leadership isn't assured. We're being challenged. So here's the question. What do we do about it? And here's the point where when you're retired, you say, well, not sure. Thanks for inviting me. And, you know, I get to leave. But I won't do that today. I think there are some things that we can do. We do need to remain strong. We need to be a strong world leader. Someone described to me a long time ago that there's no United States for the United States to fall back on. We're it. We're it. And like it or not, we're it. We need to be very careful about how we view our role in the world and what we think those changes in that role can mean for us in the long run. So our leadership, our alliances, our partnerships are critical for our security and for the security and stability of the world at large. Our economy, our diplomacy, need to remain the foundation of our security. And that security has to be backed by a strong military. And in that regard, here's what the leadership of the Department of Defense has been saying. We still have to be able to deter attack against our homeland and the homelands of our allies and partners. Nuclear weapons remain the bedrock of that deterrence. I don't like it, but that's the way it is. You can't uninvent them. And until something comes along to take their place in terms of their deterrent value, we're going to have them. But we need to modernize them. It's been a long time. It's been since the Reagan administration, since we invested in our nuclear deterrent in a significant way. We are living off the returns of that investment and the returns of the investment before that. So it's time for us to move out. We're out of time to modernize our nuclear deterrent. But for deterrence, we have to include other tools. Missile defenses that are prudent, long-range conventional weapons, and other things. We have to improve our readiness. The United States gets a tremendous advantage out of being able to project military power around the world. Some would say we can do that with impunity because we've made it look so easy. But adversaries have gone to school on us for the last 50 or more years that we've been able to project military power. And they know what they must do in order to deny us that capability. So, we've got to do something different as well. We have to be more resilient against cyber threats. We need to be more resilient against threats to our critical space assets. We have to spend more time investing in systems and concepts and people that allow us to continue to deter. You want to deter a conflict from happening. You don't actually want to fight it. You want to prevent it. You want to stop it from occurring before it ever gets started. And in order to do that, you've got to convince an enemy that they can't achieve their objectives or that they will suffer unacceptable consequences if they try, or both. So we're going to have to apply America's innovation, our technological prowess, and our industrial capacity to national security. That's not a new concept. We've been doing that since World War II. We're the ones that applied the industrial age and high technology to national security. It's time for us to apply information, the information age and information technology, to national security as well. So some things we're going to have to do. We're going to have to be able to pull technology in faster than we can today. Technology is advancing at a rapid pace. We have to be able to pull it in to national security without taking years to decide what we want to buy and how we want to go about buying it. We need to be able to integrate things better. This is a fancy way to say we've got to be able to connect the dots. We've made tremendous investments in our military. The secret sauce isn't in necessarily in making more investment in Platform A or Platform B. It's in figuring out how you link Platform A and Platform B and Platform C and Platform D together. Awful lot of stuff that's out there in a battle space anymore. You need to be able to put the pieces together. And when you can, that is incredibly, incredibly powerful. It is the secret sauce that has made the United States military the envy of everybody else. That and our young men and women who get to man this. When I worked for Secretary of Defense Bob Gates, he used to say, platforms aren't what this is all about. People is what this is ultimately all about. We need game-changing innovation, the equivalent of night vision, precision strike, stealth platforms, and other things that we have put in the field that have given us a leap ahead over other adversaries. Where are those tomorrow? Is it new materials? Is it artificial intelligence? Is it data management? Those kind of things, we need to have game-changing innovation, and we need to have more speed. But mostly, we need to be able to appeal to, recruit, and retain the young people that are necessary to keep us at the forefront of all others in the world. So, finally, just let me say this. These are big ideas. We're capable of meeting the challenges that face us today. Sometimes it doesn't seem like it, depending on when you turn on the TV and who you're watching. But my view is we don't have any unsolvable problems here. But we can leverage some things that would make some of this easier on us. Many of you represent commercial firms. Commercial is where a lot of the innovation is going on today. That's where a lot of space innovation is going on today. The government doesn't hold on all the best ideas or all the biggest investments. Just think about how long it took us to produce and deploy the F-35 stealth fighter. That's the new fighter that the Navy, the Marines, and the Air Force are buying, as well as our allies. That F-35 fighter took probably 2 decades from the time somebody said we needed a new fighter until we're actually getting it into the fleets in numbers. Did it take that long to get the iPhone out there? Nope. If there's a change to the iPhone, I mean, I can't tell what version. I don't have an iPhone. I've got a Samsung Android thingy. And I've got to tell you, every time I turn around, there's a new one. And I'm just figuring out this one. And I've had it for, it's ancient. I've had it for a year. By the way, if anybody knows how to make the fingerprint thing on this thing work, I'm about to throw this thing out over there. We're on the fourth floor over here in the hotel, and it'll be perfect. Perfect. I could get it a long way. So where are the opportunities? Well, commercial, I think. That's where the innovation is going on. Silicon Valley is a place that amazing things happen. And by the way, there are Silicon Valleys in other places besides Silicon Valley. We need better partnerships. We need better partnerships with industry. We need better partnerships with others out there in the world. I know that's a third rail issue, but I can tell you again, I think America in the future is going to have to rely on partners in many, many places. And then finally, I think quantum computing, autonomy, drones, those kind of things are equally important as we go forward. And in many cases, those things are being rapidly put forth out of consumer-driven technology. So how can you help? Well, the first thing I would suggest to you is take a breath. Everybody needs to take a breath. Just, you know, okay. You know, it isn't urgent versus important. Not everything is urgent breaking news. Take a breath. Stay informed, because I think you staying informed carries a great deal of clout when you get informed and then engaged. And I would help you to do that in any way I can. Look for opportunities to be supportive, not just of the troops. And by the way, don't just say, we support the troops. But where are the opportunities for you to really support the troops? Support the young people like you're doing here. That's tremendous. Because what I'd really like to do is send all 8 of them who spoke to the Air Force recruiter. So there will be a line over here afterwards. I've got the papers. Because they are exactly the kind of people that the military needs today and for tomorrow. So look for opportunities to be supportive. Stay engaged. Continue to do what you're doing here. And I know that that we will all be in a better place. Thank you again for inviting me, and I look forward to your questions.
Thank you, sir. Thank you, sir. We have a few questions. I'm sorry, but there are about five cards I cannot read the handwriting on, so I'm putting those on the bottom. Anyhow, I've tried on a few of them here. Here's the first one that's top of my stack. What do you think of the tech companies not willing to work with the Defense Department?
Yeah, I don't care for that. I think the question was, you know, what about the tech companies, the U.S. tech companies working with the Department of Defense? They all have to make their own decisions. You know, companies have been making those decisions for a very long time, and that's not new. I do think that there is a way that these tech companies can work with the government. Some cases, I think we have to find a way. But I think I wouldn't go so far as saying that I think that U.S. companies all have an obligation to work with the Department of Defense. I'm not sure that's true. But I would say that I think there are ways for the tech companies to work with the Department of Defense, and the Department of Defense can use their help.
In your opinion, is defense spending proportional to education spending?
Well, yeah, I guess I would answer with a resounding, it depends. You know, there's the Defense Department doesn't get funded partially by public donations or public things and the government. The government's it for the Department of Defense. Education is a little different, I would say. I think, obviously, there's a government responsibility. So I serve on an advisory board at my alma mater at Penn State. And this has been a big surprise to me. Less than 10% of Penn State's budget comes from the state of Pennsylvania. Less than 10%. I'll bet it's the same at Florida State. I'll bet it's the same. I don't know. Does anybody know what that percentage is of state funding for the state, quote-unquote, state institutions? Is it much higher? Well, there you go. It's time to move to Florida. but here's my point. Obviously, those two things go hand in hand. Our national security is based on not just investment in the Department of Defense, but investment in us, in our youngsters, in education, in other things, in social-related things, too. So I think, you know, national strength comes from a lot of places. I would say, though, that the sources of funding for education, it would be interesting to compare sort of total investment from the government source for the Defense Department and then total investment from all sources for education and see if there's a big difference. I don't know if there is or not, but certainly education is important. It's important inside the Department of Defense, and that's we pull people into the Department of Defense, youngsters, from our education system. So it's important to invest there, too.
Next question, do we need to worry about Iran and North Korea? I assume whoever wrote this, it means nuclear when we're talking about Iran and North Korea primarily. I don't know that, but that's kind of what I'm guessing in looking at this question.
Yeah, so let me address it. The answer is yes. We do need to be worried about both of them, not just because of nuclear weapons. You know, it's interesting. Nuclear weapons are used every day. They're not used in combat every day, thankfully, and haven't been since August of 1945, and if we do it right, won't be used in combat again. But they get used every day. They're used by some for coercion. They're used by some for deterrence. They're used constantly. They've been in use by the United States since August of 1945, and I think to good effect We have not had a major power war like World War I or World War II since nuclear weapons were used in 1945. There's a reason for that. Iran uses nuclear weapons that it doesn't even have. So these things get used all the time. But beyond that, I think both North Korea and Iran fall in that category of nations that certainly are not working along with the family of nations to bring peace and prosperity to the world. And I think that in both of those cases, there has been and continues to be an obligation on our part to be a leader here and help keep those two nations in as contained a fashion as we can. Iran, I can tell you from my friends who have worked in the Gulf, is up to no good vis-a-vis the United States and our interests in the Gulf.
We have had air superiority for many years. Do we still have it, and can we keep it?
Yeah, the answer is yes, we do, but we're not going to have it forever unless we take some steps to deal with it. And I would add space superiority to that as well, because there was a time when we said the great enabler for U.S. military operations was air superiority, but it's also space superiority. The way we use space today, just think about GPS. All of you use GPS every day, whether you need to go somewhere or not. GPS, not only location information, but timing information, allows us to maintain synchronization for banking transactions, for example. Your ATM machines are timed so that business can be transacted, and that timing comes through GPS. So overhead communications, GPS, intelligence, surveillance, and reconnaissance from space are all critical. Air superiority is critical, and in both of those cases, the bad guys have watched us use those things. Those enable the American way of warfare, and they are working actively to deny us both of those. If we don't act, then there will come a time when U.S. forces, for the first time since the 1950s, will come under attack from the air, and that we can't accept.
One final question. Are you ready? Has President Trump tried to tell you what to do?
So I retired. So let me say a couple of things. So some military officers over our history, not just officers, military veterans, people have left the military and they have run for public office and they have served the nation very well. My view is that people like that have crossed over into politics, and they should have at it. Whatever they, you know, whatever politicians do, they are okay as far as I'm concerned. Dwight Eisenhower became the president of the United States. He was General Eisenhower. And even though they still called him General Eisenhower, he crossed over into the political world. So be it. Bob Kaler did not. And so my view is my rank followed me into retirement. So does my oath of office, which means that I need to remain apolitical. And I believe that our military, in particular our retired military, needs to remain apolitical. We do not have a political military, despite what you hear from all kinds of directions on TV. We do not have a political military. You don't want a political military, and our republic isn't based on a political military. So, my view on this is my responsibility, and to demonstrate this to the youngsters that are coming along, I must remain apolitical. Having said that, when you come up through the ranks in the United States military, up through two stars, the way you get those promotions is you meet a promotion board. You are screened by your military service. They come up with a list of who they believe should be promoted. That list goes to the Secretary of Defense. Secretary of Defense, if the Secretary approves this is civilian control of the military, sends it over to the White House and recommends to the President, recommend to the Senate that be approved. It goes to the Senate, and there you go. up through two stars, the rank goes with the human being. Three and four stars, the rank does not go with the human being. The rank goes with the job. And so, when I got nominated for a third star, I was nominated. And so, three and four stars, you get nominated by the president with the and confirmed with the advice and consent of the Senate. That's the way it works. So, my third star, I guess I was nominated by George Bush. George W. Bush. I served as a three-star, and I was confirmed by the Senate. When I got nominated for a fourth star, the first time, I was nominated twice. First time I was nominated, I think I was nominated by George W. Bush that time as well. And I was confirmed by the Senate. And the Senate, by the way, the Armed Services Committee votes on you, recommends to the full Senate, and then the Senate gets to vote. The second time I was nominated for a four-star job, I was nominated by President Obama. So this notion that we are somehow Obama's generals or Bush's generals or Trump's generals, or it's just not true. It's not the way it works. So please, if you leave with something that you've learned today, be very cautious about buying into the notion that somehow we are politically selected or politically affiliated as serving officers. It's just not true. So to the question, first of all, I never served for President Trump. But I can tell you this, for all of the politicians that I was around as a senior officer, all they ever asked of me was my honest military advice. And I got asked that, especially as the commander of Strategic Command when I owned the country's nuclear deterrent. Never once, on any flavor of politician here, did I believe that somebody was telling me how I had to think, what I had to do, how I had to reply. Now, I must say, the first time I sat across the table from the President of the United States to have a little conversation, I thought pretty carefully about what I was going to say. It's like Thanksgiving. You get one shot at the adults' table. And so, you know, if you eat your ice cream like that, that's somebody notices. So I was pretty careful about what I said and how I said it, but nobody told me what to say or how to say it. So I think I find it very disturbing when I listen to some combination of our political leaders and our commentators who want to suggest that the military is politicized. It's not so, and we collectively need to make sure it doesn't become so. I apologize for the lecture there, but I, as you can tell, I feel pretty strongly about this, and I think this is one of those things that the country demands that its military operate in a couple of critical constitutional principles, one of which is civilian control of the military, and the other is an apolitical military that renders its advice and executes its missions without regard to political influence. Do you understand what the politicians are trying to do? Of course, it's policy. That's what the military gets told to go execute, objectives that the policymakers lay out for us. But it's not a political military. So with that, thank you.
General, we have a couple presents here for you to take with you to remember your trip to Naples and Marco Island, a book on Marco contributed by one of our members, and also a book on Naples for you to take with you.
Thank you very much. Okay. Thanks, Dave. Thanks. Thank you.
Got some. I need some of the handwriting. I wish I would be that bad when I'm on your team. It's hard.
I thought they were good questions.
Oh, yeah. Here's one I...